Hello, and welcome to Radio Aldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Aldie. And I'm delighted to be interviewing our greatest royal biographer, Hugo Vickers, to talk to him about his latest book, Clarissa, Muse to Power, the untold story of Clarissa Eden, Countess of Avon, who had an extraordinary life, living from 1920 to 2021, married to Anthony Eden, and the niece of Winston Churchill. And she's most famous for saying, if she did say, Hugo, that the Suez Canal flowed through her drawing room. She did say something like that?
She said it and she regretted it. She regretted the word drawing room, which she felt in the end came to haunt her. It was a speech that she made up in Yorkshire when he was ill, just before they went off to Jamaica in the middle of the Suez Crisis.
In 1956.
Yep. And she did say, it does seem to me sometimes that the Suez Canal is flowing through my drawing room. And it was the only time she wanted to make a really political speech, but she does actually, in that speech, which I have done my best to repeat in full, but one can't be certain that it was delivered as written, if you know what I mean. But anyway, yep. There it is. Because she does talk about the issues of Suez and what the Prime Minister was trying to do, and she tries to put things straight. And then, of course, off they went to Jamaica, to Goldeneye, Ian Fleming's house. And the only person who came out of that with flying colours was Ian Fleming himself, because he put Goldeneye on the map. The Edens were criticised for leaving the country at that time, criticised for going abroad. But as Clarissa said, if he hadn't gone, he would have died at that point. He was so ill.
Because in your brilliant book and your brilliant article you wrote about in the Aldie, exactly about this, you said that he didn't, she said that he didn't make a hash of Suez because he was ill. If he made a hash, he made a hash. Is that right?
Which is very interesting, I think. He was ill, of course, at the very end, no question about it. When they came back from Jamaica, by that stage he'd lost the confidence of the House of Commons, and it was clear he had to go. But her line was that, you know, he took a line about Suez and that he certainly wasn't on amphetamines and all the things that people accuse him of at the beginning. He, therefore, he had, you know, the mistake he made, I guess, was to feel that Britain, having sort of won the war, though they won it with a lot of help, was still a big power. And, he wanted to sort of have a go at NASA and do something. And he also thought that the Americans would come in and help him. Eisenhower was in the middle of an election campaign. If it had been the Panama Canal instead of the Suez Canal, he might have been more interested. But no, he didn't. But at the same time, whereas it's perfectly fair to say that Eden could have talked direct to Eisenhower, he also relied very much on Harold Macmillan, his foreign secretary. And of course, Clarissa certainly thought that he misled Eden. And the result, as we know, is that whatever you think about Suez, who fell? Eden fell, and who took over? Macmillan.
And you have a brilliant quote of when Macmillan in turn fell in 1963. She wrote to Cecil Beaton about Macmillan, "I must say I couldn't have wished a more squalid exit for a man I've always disliked and distrusted." So she said what she thought, is that right?
She certainly did. This is what I found really so enjoyable about her, was that she was extremely sharp, sometimes very acerbic, always very forthright, and she knew her own mind. And, I mean, she was probably one of the most interesting of all the wives of prime ministers who've lived in Downing Street. As I said in your article for you, you know, she knew Cocteau and Gertrude Stein and all these people. She great friend of James Pope Hennessy, indeed Cecil Beaton, Isaiah Berlin, and all these sort of characters. I mean, these are very interesting people, and they all adored her. They were all enthralled by her. And so there are some amazingly wonderful letters between them in which the story is told, really.
And although her maiden name was Clarissa Spencer Churchill, in theory she was Winston Churchill's niece, but she wasn't, in fact. Can you explain that?
Well, it's very complicated because Jack was Winston's younger brother, but it's now been proved by DNA that he was a Boscawen, so he was not a son of Lord Randolph Churchill, something which Clarissa's brother Peregrine would have gone apoplectic about and indeed sometimes went to law about. But anyway, that's now been proved. But this doesn't really matter, because actually Clarissa wasn't Jack's daughter either. She was born several years after her two brothers, Johnny and Peregrine, in 1920, and she was the daughter of Harold Baker, Bluey or Blue Tooth Baker, the warden of Winchester College, who was a highly intelligent, very interesting man, tremendously good plantsman. I've got various notebooks of his, which I simply can't understand at all, which I hope will go to Winchester College so one day, with all sorts of extraordinary things written in Greek and so forth. And he was a highly intelligent, interesting man, and he was a very, very strong friend to Clarissa all her life. And she only really discovered that she was his daughter when he died, and he'd left her all his books and indeed a wood.
Which was in 1960, I think he died.
Which was in 1960, yes, exactly.
And what were the circumstances of his affair with Clarissa's mother?
Well, that we don't know, but Clarissa herself, of course, like most of us, couldn't believe her own parents were having sex, let alone that her mother was having sex with somebody else. But he was very much around and a great feature in their lives, very close to her mother. And I don't know exactly how it happened or... Well, we know when it happened,
yeah.
But I don't know how it happened. But he went on being a great friend to Clarissa after her mother died as well. Anyway, there's no doubt about it, he was definitely her father.
And despite the fact that she wasn't then related to Winston Churchill, they were close. And in fact, you've got a terrific picture of the Churchills, Winston and Clemmy Churchill, at the wedding of Anthony Eden and Clarissa in 1952.
Which, of course, was very interesting because Winston could never keep a secret, so he wasn't told. But she wrote to Aunt Clemmy, who was out in Capri, who then came rushing home to arrange the wedding in Downing Street. They hoped to get married very quietly in August 1952. But, of course, what they didn't anticipate was the fact that there was no other news in August at all. And when their wedding took place at Caxton Hall, it was like Elizabeth Taylor and Michael Wilding, you know, crowds of people. And she was also... So whisked into Downing Street and couldn't go out for several days before, you know, because there were so many crowds outside. It was a real sort of film star wedding.
She was wonderful looking. I saw her with you in great old age. Even at 100, this terrific bone structure she had.
Oh, she did. She was very, very good looking. But I must also tell you that at the wedding, Duff Cooper was amused to hear from Fulke Warwick, Anthony's nephew, who's there, that Winston said the marriage... that we have today, that we have seen consummated. And as Duff Cooper said, imagine if he had.
Very good. And so to paint a picture, she has this extraordinary youth, extremely well connected, and she's an intellectual, is that right? And mixes with Gertrude Stein and Jean Cocteau, James Pope Hennessy, Isaiah Berlin.
Very much so. She was a very remote child. She once said that she never spoke unless she had something interesting to say, by which she meant something interesting to her to say. And so quite often she didn't speak at all and didn't want to have a season, didn't want to do anything like that. Went off to Paris and had a lovely time there for a year and then came back, had a miserable going to parties and things, and then went at one point went back to Paris and then the war came. Then she went to Oxford. But of course she wasn't at Oxford. She was in Oxford. But... it wasn't long before she was being taught philosophy by the great dons of the day, you know, Professor Price, Peck, by Isaiah Berlin and people like Freddie Eyre, all taking an interest in her, to the point that Philip Toynbee said, it's absolutely outrageous you come here and you're not even enrolled in the university. At one point, she was even wearing a gown, attending these lectures.
At the correct undergraduate age, is it?
Yes, absolutely, right. Yes. And all the undergraduates, I mean, she was like Zuleika Dobson. I mean, they were all falling in love with her. And there was, all this is told through letters, and I have all the letters. And one letter from Trim Oxford, who lived at Mell's, and wonderful house, that's a whole other...
Lord Oxford.
Lord Oxford and Asquith.
Figure, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And indeed, of course, Catherine Asquith, his mother, Bluey Baker, was trying to marry her. So he was often at Mell's with Gooney, Clarissa's mother, and Catherine, and old Lady Horner. I mean, it's a fantastic setup, the whole thing. And so Trim is writing to her, and she's keeping him close, but not actually having an affair with him. But at one point, Raymond Carr comes in and says...
distinguished Oxford Don.
Indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
That saw that you were out. I'll come back at 5 o'clock. He writes on the envelope of Trim's letter. It's outrageous.
And so she has these... distinguished friends and boyfriends as well, you would say?
Well, the point is that the reason none of them got anywhere, people like David Wallace and Charlie Lansdowne and all these people, was because she was having an affair with Jeremy Hutchinson, Indeed, one of your guests, I seem to remember, as
yes,
an oldie of
yes,
the year.
Who lived, I think also lived to 100.
He did, well over 100. Yeah. Yeah, he behaved very, very badly. And he kept appearing and then disappearing and sort of say it was all too much. And then suddenly, having gone, he was pleading, you know, he missed her so much. But he didn't miss her that much because he then went off and married Peggy Ashcroft, 9 years older than him, with two marriages behind her already.
And so what were the circumstances of her then meeting and marrying Eden?
The funny thing is that the first time she met him, there's one diary which turned up from 1936, and it was found by some kind lady tucked down the side of a chair, and this lady sent it back to Clarissa, and she never mentioned it at all. But anyway, I found it after she died. And at Cranbourne, staying with, I think, probably with David Cecil at that point, the Edens, Anton Eden and his wife Beatrice, come, and Clarissa meets him, is rather amazed by his green tweed suit, and then says in her diary, "God help us from Mr. Eden if he ever runs this country." That was her first reaction. I wish I'd known that. I could have asked her whether she still thought that later on. Anyway, they met in about 1947, I suppose, 48, that sort of time. And he asked her out to dinner, and she used to go and stay with him at Binderton, his house in Sussex, sometimes. But for a long time it was, no, I couldn't possibly marry him. He's far too whimsical. He talks to his plants, you know, and, no, it's absolutely out of the question.
And 20 years older than her, was he?
Yes, yes. Yeah. 1897 he was born, so yeah. 23 years older. And yeah. Then he did propose to her at one point and she turned him down. And people like Cecil Beaton, James Bay Pennessy and Pamela Hartwell, Pamela Berry, were all encouraging her, even Duff Cooper, I think, to marry him, thought that this would give her this wonderful platform, that she would be the most incredibly amazing political wife, as in some ways, briefly, she was. But once she'd married him, she was absolutely horrified and thought, oh, my God, what have I done? And because there they were sort of thrown together. That was August 52. By May 1953, he was at death's door with his terrible illnesses. And Churchill terrified the surgeon, who then actually couldn't operate for 45 minutes. And when he did, he cut the bile duct. As a result
of
which,
was his actual condition?
Well, he was having sort of terrible gastric problems and things. And after that, as a result of having the bile duct cut, he had fevers the rest of his life and had to have many more operations. But what Clarissa said was that brought out his courage, his sweet nature, and her caring side, because she did have a very caring side, despite this rather acerbic approach to so many people. And so, you know, and she looked after him. And once he had stepped down, you know, from Suez, They had a house in Bequia near Mustique, then they had a house in Barbados. They travelled a lot and she made lovely homes for him in Wiltshire, beautiful gardens. I mean, he was incredibly well fed and never put on not a pound of weight, but, you know, just had a lovely time. And I think she really missed him very much when he died.
Although you do say Suez did hang over them the rest of their lives, is that
inevitably
right?
Inevitably, and then of course even not only the rest of their lives, because he was protected from the worst that people were going to say by the laws of libel while he was alive, but she spent an awful lot of time in the latter years defending his reputation. And as you know, this is what happens sometimes, that the further you get away from the actual events and the people who really knew about it, the more outrageous the statements people will make, because they can't be denied. So she had to go several times she had Lord Goodman protecting her, so he helped a fair amount.
But the people being libelous about her,
well,
were they?
And then her too, yes. I mean, she had to put up with quite a lot. So as Keeper of the Flame, she's very much the Keeper of the Flame. She wasn't going to have any nonsense. She commissioned Robert Rhodes James to write one biography, didn't like it. So she commissioned D.R. Thorpe to write a much more sympathetic one.
You say in your book and in your brilliant articles, she's very open and honest. There's a terrific dinner party in 1982 with Nicholas Shakespeare. If you could be as rude as you can be about that dinner.
Well, I asked her to a dinner with the Emmanuels, who did the wedding dress for the Princess of Wales. They weren't probably natural friends of Clarissa, but nevertheless interesting and nice. And then a friend of mine, and also Nicholas Shakespeare, and he didn't seem to know who she was. So she kept on having to say things like, well, I was in the cradle when that was happening. And she went off next day, she said, I think he thought I was Asquith's widow. But at one point, Nicholas had been investigating the sale of vibrators for some programme that he was doing. And he was telling us about how many vibrators were being bought by the women of this country. And if I was at all worried about my distinguished guest, I needn't have done at all, because she suddenly weighed in with, "Do you mean to say that you can get circumcised ones and uncircumcised ones?" And I thought, good for
brilliant,
her.
Brilliant, unshockable. And also, yes. She was quite... She teased you quite a bit. You tell a very, very good story about James Fairfax.
Well, yes. James Fairfax was a, you know, friend in common, as one calls it, a philanthropist, and he lived at in his later years in Bowral, which is between Canberra and Sydney, which is quite a long way, about 300 miles. And I was flying from Canberra to Sydney. He got to hear that I was doing that, and he said, no, come and have lunch. And he sent a car to Canberra, pick me up, take me to Bowral, give me a very good lunch, and the car take me on to Sydney. So when I said this to Clarissa, did she say, how nice of him? Not at all, much more, much funnier. She said, he must have been desperate for company.
Very good. And you have a very good comment about her leaving a dinner party in Patmos.
Well, yes, I mean, her way of leaving a dinner party was to say to me, at the end of things, she suddenly said, I think we've exhausted the social possibilities of this meal, don't you?
That's very good. Because she wasn't craven to anyone. She, like you, disliked Mountbatten. Is that fair enough?
Very much so. We bonded over a dislike of Mountbatten. And she said in 1980, I've avoided going to any of the 20 memorial services for him. She told the story that Mountbatten had tried to, she said, was perverting the course of history because he had so much money, that he had these loose boxes at Broadlands and used to get people to go in there and record wonderful things about him for his programme, you know, My Life and My Times by Myself, Lord Mountbatten, which was sort of 10 episodes, or actually quite fun, but they are amusing for various reasons. And he said to Anthony Eden, I'd like you to come down to my studio and record that you met me at London Airport and congratulated me on how I handled India. So my Lord Avon consulted Alan Noble, his private secretary, and said, is it possible that I was ever at London Airport with Dickie? No, absolutely not. So he said this to him, and Mountbatten just said, oh, well, it must have been another occasion. But anyway, he didn't do it.
And so she was extremely original, and you say she didn't madly like the royal family. She was a Zionist, so she had the courage of her conviction. She didn't feel she should stay quiet on anything particular.
No, I mean, I used to love talking to her about plays and films and things. And if she said I thought it was banal and predictable, I immediately said, oh, I can't wait to go and see it. You know, I'm sure I'll enjoy it enormously. Which, you know, she was very often right about things. And she was, I mean, I remember watching her. I stayed with her quite often, and I used to wonder how she spent her time she wasn't that old as a widow, but she did a lot of gardening and listening to beautiful music and things. But, I mean, I loaned her a Caroline Blackwood novel, and she just ripped through it in about 3 hours flat and took it all in.
And did she feel frustrated in widowhood? Or because she was, to us journalists, she always seemed like a sort of slightly obscure figure who was hiding herself away. Is that incorrect?
Well, I think she was quite grand, and I think she was wise to sort of keep away from many people. She selected her friends very carefully, and I was very, very flattered that she chose to make me a friend because, you know, as I said, many of the things that I like, she didn't particularly like and so forth, but just somehow it worked, and I think I was able to amuse her somehow. And John Stephanidis made an interesting point. He said that he thought there was a slight dilemma between being a prime minister's widow and being this bohemian character, because she would love travelling and she liked her deep sea diving and she would, you know, do all sorts of things. But equally, although she didn't necessarily want to go to St Paul's Cathedral for the Queen Mother's 80th birthday, she wasn't particularly pleased if she was overlooked.
I see. Yes.
You know, the status was there. So that was always a bit complicated. But I mean, again, as you say, she didn't madly like the royal family, but she very much liked Princess Margaret. She thought she was very interesting, and she liked Princess Alexandra, and she used to entertain them because she liked them.
And you're at least 30 years younger than her. How did you come to know her and become a friend of hers?
I was originally taken to see her in 1975 by my aunt. I mean, there was a family connection because Jack Churchill, her supposed father, was a partner of my grandfather in Vicars da Costa. So the family had always known each other. And when I was writing my book about Lady Stephen, Duchess of Marlborough, my aunt got in touch with Clarissa and asked if she remembered her and whether we could come and talk to her. And Clarissa didn't madly like my aunt because Jack, her father, did like my aunt very much. And Clarissa said, therefore, my aunt was the bane of her childhood. He was always taking her out in a boat and things. Anyway, that's a whole other... It's in the book, but it's all another part of it. But anyway, luckily she did. So we went over there to talk to her about Gladys, and that was fascinating. And then, of course, when I wrote my Gladys book, it was published by Lord Weidenfeld, who was another friend of hers, and then she reappeared, and she liked that book, and I think she was... I never asked her, but I'm sure she was instrumental in steering me towards doing the Cecil Beaton biography, because she was a great friend of his. And certainly it didn't do any harm that I knew her, as far as he was concerned, and he would have respected her feelings. And she did then say to me, I hear you're taking Cecil on, as she called him. And then she sort of said, more or less sort of said, well, you know, he'll want to be in the centre of this book. Keep pushing him out.
How good. So often one finds that famous or well-connected people don't actually have a very good memory of all the things they've seen because they've been too busy showing off themselves. But it sounds like she was absorbing a lot and she remembered a lot when she talked to you. Is that right?
Yes, she did. And what was also interesting, which I think would be confirmed by any of the other biographers who went to see her, is that she didn't say, if somebody went to see her about Evelyn Waugh, she didn't talk about her friendship with Evelyn Waugh. She assumed that the person had come to see her because they knew that she knew him, and then she would talk about what she thought about him. That's unique. I've never seen that. Everybody else, it's always about themselves, right, really, and the person. Why not? Which is interesting anyway, but yeah, that she was able to do.
And at what moment did she anoint you as her biographer?
She didn't anoint me as her biographer. She anointed me as her literary executor, but in 1994 she wrote me a letter saying, you know, I'm giving you all the papers and I leave it entirely up to you what you publish. By the time that it occurred to me that it would be really interesting to write about her, it was sort of too late to talk to her about it, I thought. But, I don't know but what you think, but I think if you consign your papers to a biographer and you talk to him a lot and you tell him... She knew I knew a lot of her secrets because I'd read them in Cecil Beaton's diaries. I think, you know, she wouldn't be totally surprised.
No, and also you knew her extremely well. I always think it's extremely good if someone's writing a biography, they actually know what someone was like. You don't, with the best of the will, start to make things up about someone's character as you necessarily do if you don't know someone.
Well, I think it's an interesting thing. I was thinking on my way here, you know, I'm a little bit like a surgeon now if I write a book. You know, a surgeon is sort of has years of experience, which means that he can then perform an operation quite adroitly. And I think the fact of having known her for 41 years and observed her closely, and luckily kept diaries in which I wrote down quite a lot of the things that she said at the time because I thought they were so riveting, I think that's a help. And that's what, in a way, enabled me to write the book, really. Because a lot of things I would have forgotten if I hadn't written them down, I hate to say.
Always, inevitably the way. And so you had access to unpublished papers and, I believe, unpublished photographs as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, absolute... You name it, I had it, and fantastic. And all the Suez diaries, which were she'd put onto cassette, and some of them she'd used. She had written a memoir, but it wasn't very good, which was a joy to me, of course, because...
Which was published.
Which was published. Right. But George Weidenfeld, I think, just gave her some money to do this book, and she... Well, I looked at it the other day. Basically, whenever anyone was mentioned, she gave a sort of character sketch of them, but she's not really in the book. You don't really get to know her at all. It was reasonably favourably reviewed, gently reviewed, perhaps I should say, by her
friends.
When
did that come out?
That came out, again, perhaps it was too late, 2007, roughly, I think. And she was already there for 86, 87. She worked with Kate Haste, which, you know, again, what Kate Haste had put together for the research notes was absolutely brilliant.
Wrote extensively about Prime Minister's wives.
That's how it had come to be. To begin with, it was all to do with Prime Minister's wives. And then, and the Goldfish Bowl, they did that programme. And there is actually a very funny video of Clarissa returning to Downing Street in the days of Cherie Blair and coming into the drawing room and looking around and saying, oh, yes, I see. But I must say, I've become a huge fan of Cherie Blair because she was incredibly nice to talk to me about Clarissa. And the one thing that came up in the libel report, the lawyer said, you simply cannot say that, she gave me permission to say, which was that Clarissa, and she had had a long conversation, which there was a transcript of, and Clarissa said the boring thing about Downing Street were the secretaries who arrived with their boxes first thing in the morning in the bedroom, and were very often there late at night. And Cherie said, well, I threatened to take my clothes off, and that gets them out pretty quickly. Anyway, she said, of course you can use that.
Yes. And Clarissa had no children, is that right?
No, she had two miscarriages.
Right.
And she never had any children. I don't know. That would have been interesting. I thought a lot about whether she would have been a good mother. She probably would have been, because she was, you know, she was so well brought up. She sort of knew what to do, but it might have been tricky.
And Eden had children by his first marriage, is that right?
He had three sons. One of them we don't really know about because he only lived for a few hours, and he's buried somewhere in North London, called Robert, I think. And Nicholas, the elder son, she got on very well with, and he became the second Lord Avon and became a sort of government minister in the House of Lords, but died of AIDS. That was tricky in 1985.
Because he was gay?
Yes, he had a restaurant called Nick's Diner, I think. And Simon, the other son, was killed in Korea. That was awful. That broke up the Eden's first marriage, basically.
So is there a current Lord Avon?
No, all gone.
Yeah.
No.
And Hugo, I must finish you as the greatest royal biographer alive. I thought the Remembrance Sunday was extremely moving. The King and the Princess of Wales, Prince of Wales, behaved perfectly. But the royal family looked rather sparse. The Duke of Kent was there, but are they quite low on personnel at the moment?
Well, I'm with Princess Anne on this one. I think, listen to everything Princess Anne says, and when she was asked about the slimmed down monarchy, she said it doesn't look very good from where I'm looking at it. And I mean, I thought that it showed tremendous unity, really. There was something, I mean, they've had such a horrible year, that there was the King, there was the Princess, Prince of Wales, there was the Princess on the balcony with Sophie Edinburgh, as we must now call her, who you may have seen put a sort of arm behind her in a sort of nice, sort of solicitous way. Duke of Kent was there in his great coat, which was splendid, on the balcony. And yes, they are. And then, of course, Queen Camilla wasn't there because she's got a chest infection. In the summer, Prince William stood in for the King and gave a garden party, hosted a garden party. He got all the cousins to come along, all the Tyndalls and the York princesses and things. And I know somebody who went to that. And it was great fun. And the reason I suspect that it was great fun was because there was a lot of young energy. Prince Philip said some years ago, some older people can relate to the Queen Mother's generation, some of them relate to our generation, some to the children. When the Queen was alive, you had a four-tier royal family. You had them as this wonderful, you know, untouchable, brilliant couple. Then you had the Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall, then you had the Cambridges, and then you had the children who appeared from time to time. And so I think actually what you need to do is to get more of the youngsters moving around and doing things, because with the best will in the world, you know, an elderly king with an elderly queen is not as romantic as, you know, the younger ones.
And do you think a younger one will be booking a flight from Montecito back to London? There are rumours that Prince Harry is longing to come back. Have you heard anything along those lines?
Well, Prince Harry has apparently bought a property in Portugal, which might prove to be rather wise, because along with all the people that Trump is intending to chuck out could well be Prince Harry. I mean, that would be a very sort of typical, I mean, Trump's got more important things on his mind, let's face it, but it would be a cheap and sort of a cheap publicity shot, wouldn't it, to say out he goes, because Trump goes around telling people that he was the Queen's favourite president. When somebody told me this, I said, don't you think that's rather clever of the Queen? Don't you think she made them all feel they were the most favourite president? I'm sure she did. But at any rate, he did get on very well with the Queen, and he does actually blame Prince Harry, as one might well do, for causing the Queen a lot of distress in the last couple of years of her life. So I don't think it's going to work for him to come back as sort of like as a working royal, because there's so much focus of attention on him that would deflect from what the royal family are doing, which is working for us, the United Kingdom, the Commonwealth, selflessly going out, showing the kind of unity that they did on Remembrance Sunday, and not doing things for themselves. That's the big difference.
Well, that's a very good place to end my interview with our greatest royal biographer, Hugo Vickers, talking about his wonderful new book, Clarissa, Muse to Power, The Untold Story of Clarissa Eden, Countess of Avon. Hugo, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.